welcome friends, and welcome to this special devotional meeting, ULT Day. And we thank you for joining us because we're going to be looking back at the founding of the United Lodge of Theosophists, and we will looking later on at its mission and future, informing informing us all of how this philosophy has been carried on. We will be acknowledging Theosophy's ability to carry on along the lines laid down by the ancient teachings. And the question may come up, well, what does Robert Crosby have to do with the formation of the United Lodge of Theosophists? So when we consider that, we must look at his life and contribution of this founder. Mr. Crosby was born January 10th, 1849, in Montreal, Canada. He was of Scottish lineage. He was not an only child, but we do not know anything about his siblings. He was raised as a Presbyterian, but never felt comfortable with its dogma or rituals. His mother had what Mr. Crosby called second sight, a faculty inherited from her Scottish lineage. Although she never used it per se, she did exhibit it regarding the well-being of others. He acknowledges the giving and sacrificial spirit of his mother's and the huge impact it made on him that affected him throughout his life. Not feeling connected to the Presbyterian Church, Mr. Crosby then, at the age of 16, began to search for the truth. Even at this young age, he had the strength of conviction to do the search on his own, that asking those in standard religions would only give back to him what that particular religion believed, not necessarily the truth. He realized he would have to look for that knowledge, not a belief. But he didn't know where to begin. Although he tried to immerse himself into the mundane aspects of life, he continually questioned that life about death, suffering, and other thoughts of that matter. He knew that the religion was not the answer. At the age of 20, in 1869, he went into the shoe and leather manufacturing business and married the daughter of his partner. His partner became a spiritualist after the death of his wife, but Mr. Crosby found nothing that satisfied him in this type of philosophy. He acknowledged the existence of psychic powers, but their process and purpose he questioned. He always felt that he was being protected from getting involved with these issues. He and his partner, after receiving an offer from Boston, moved the business there, where they were known for quality, honest work. There were more spiritualistic activities going on in Boston, which pleased his partner greatly. But Mr. Crosby did attend some of these seances, but he always felt there was fraud going on. He did tinker with hypnotism, which he says with unusual success and honor. It was during this time period when his partner told him of the Theosophical Society that they were starting a branch in Boston. Even the word itself intrigued him, so he went to the initial meeting. From the first, in 1887, he knew he had found the answer to all of his questions about life and death. He immersed himself into the philosophy and shortly became its secretary. And he quotes, "William Judge came to Boston soon after. I was introduced to him together with other members, and had no other notice from him until after the meeting when we had parted at the door. He going with some members to his hotel and I in the other direction. We had got some distance apart when I heard him call out, "Good night, Crosby. I've got you on my list." I said good night, but was much exercised at the rest of his remark. Something, however, happened then. A veil was lifted. A tie was formed which has never since been broken. And from that point on, they remained close friends and co-workers for the philosophy. Mr. Crosby soon was made president of the Boston branch, as well as helping to organize the 8th convention of the American section of the Theosophical Society in Boston. He remained president of the group, the Boston group, until 1900. At the time Mr. Crosby joined the TS, HPB was in India. He never did get to meet her, though he did receive correspondence from her. When Mr. Judge died March 21st, 1896 in New York City, Mr. Crosby was still in Boston. Mr. Crosby supported Catherine Tingley, who took over the head of the TS in America after the death of Mr. Judge, and she was located in Point Loma, California. At that point, he was supervising the affairs of the TS in all the New England states. In 1900, Mr. Crosby took his family and moved to Point Loma, California, where the main office of the Theosophical Society was located to support the organizing of the TS in the period of time following Mr. Judge's death. During the time period of maybe 2 years, as he was witness on the scene, he wrestled with many questions and became disillusioned with the way the transition of duties and the direction of the spiritual focus of the society was proceeding. He felt in order to keep to the original lines laid down, as was put forth by the masters, as recorded by HPB and Mr. Judge, he needed to withdraw from the society. The years following his departure from the TS were difficult. For Mr. Crosby and his family, he had donated all the family's finances to the TS. He did find a job as a bookkeeper with the Los Angeles Times, but this job was very difficult and low-paying. But, and no coincidence, some of his neighbors became very interested in theosophical ideas and formed a study group using the Ocean of Theosophy, the Key to Theosophy, and the Bhagavad Gita. And we did want to point out one thing, that we are so grateful to have all this literature, because back then, especially at the beginning, there was no literature, and they just had to rely on HPB talking and Mr. Judge talking until finally things started being written down. So we are very grateful that we have all these writings. So the study group used the Ocean of Theosophy, the Key to Theosophy, and the Bhagavad Gita. He preserved the line unbroken, so on February 18, 1909, with only 7 associates, the United Lodge of Theosophists was founded to accomplish the purpose of giving out the original writings. A major change in the formation of the ULT versus the Theosophical Society, to quote him, he said, "No formal bond existed among the associates of the ULT, the sole object being the study and dissemination of theosophy pure and simple." He stressed impersonality and anonymity to protect the work and to help protect the workers from pride and ambition. He worked tirelessly to revive the essence of the master's ideals. He brought back the 3 objects of the theosophical movement, and the three fundamental propositions of the secret doctrine. He focused on the development of universal brotherhood and the need for study and application. He believed in the mission of HPB and WQJ so much that he made the mission his own. Mr. Crosby's dedication to the fledgling ULT was enormous. He was a frequent speaker to many groups. He never turned anyone away who had questions regarding the philosophy. He responded to many letters without hesitation, and we are so grateful for that because so many of his letters are in the Friendly Philosopher, which is wonderful. He never withheld any advice, but always gave freely. In 1919, however, the toll of his dedication and his advancing age combined to create a burden he could no longer tolerate, and he passed this life on June 25th. He died as he had lived, calm and serene, with no word of complaint during the days of intense suffering that preceded his release. His writings. In 1907, he compiled Mr. Judge's ideas, uniting all into one declaration of the ULT. In 1908, he wrote a letter to all open-minded theosophists. In 1912, he produced the ULT, Its Mission and Future, The Friendly Philosopher. He edited the Theosophical Movement from 1875 to 1925, Answers to Questions on the Ocean of Theosophy, Because for Children Who Ask Why, and he also put Theosophical Songs to music himself. And he also worked on the last 11 chapters of the Gita Notes after Mr. Judge died. A quote from Magazine Theosophy, he says, HPB was the creator, WQJ was the preserver, and Mr. Crosby was the regenerator of theosophy. Excuse us, he didn't say that about himself. He would never do that. But he did say, stick to the messengers and the message. Ingratitude is not one of their vices. Go on with the work. We are working in the present for the future. Unless the nature of HPB and WQJ is grasped, theosophy is not understood and cannot be understood. Do not grieve over failures and partial successes. It is the effort that counts. He who, with a right motive and with sincere goodwill, does the best that he can, and all that he knows how to do, does enough. The next part of our devotional meeting, we will have four readings from Madame Blavatsky, Mr. Judge, and Mr. Crosby, and then we will have another talk in regards to the Theosophical Movement itself. Thank you.
The writings of H.P. Blavatsky. The recognition of pure theosophy, the philosophy of the rational explanation of things and the tenets, is of the most vital importance inasmuch as it alone can furnish the beacon light needed to guide humanity on its true path. This should never be forgotten, nor should the following fact be overlooked. On the day when Theosophy will accomplish its most holy and most important mission, namely, to unite firmly a body of men of all nations and brotherly love and bent on a pure altruistic work, not on a label with selfish motives, on that day only will Theosophy become higher than that nominal brotherhood of man. This will be a wonder and a miracle truly, for the realization of which humanity is vainly waiting for the last 18 centuries and which every association has hitherto failed to accomplish. Altruism is the keynote of Theosophy and the cure for all ills. This it is when the real founders of the Theosophical Society promote as its first object universal brotherhood. It is not violence that can ever ensure bread and comfort for all, nor is the kingdom of peace and love, of mutual help and charity and food for all, to be conquered by a cold, reasoning, diplomatic policy. It's only by the close brotherly union of men's inner selves, of soul solidarity, of the growth and development of that feeling which makes one suffer when he thinks of the suffering of others, that the reign of justice and equality for all can ever be inaugurated.
From the writings of Robert Crosby. Where shall we find the true foundation for a changed civilization that all men and women can see and stand on? It is not philosophies, nor religions, nor political panaceas that are needed, but knowledge and a wider scope of vision than the vicissitudes of one short physical life. The knowledge that is greater than all the forms of religion ever invented is knowledge of the very nature of man himself, for himself, and in himself. For we are not here as things apart, we are here because of one great sustaining cause, infinite and omnipresent, nor separate from us, nor from any other being. It is the same in all beings above the human and in all beings below the human, the very root of our natures, the very man himself. It is the source of all powers and of all actions, whether good or evil. Then, everything that is done by beings affects all beings, and all that has been caused by beings, each one affected according to his share in the cause. What the past has been, we are experiencing now, our lives now being but repetitions of lives that preceded them. What the future will be, we are making now. We are going to have a league of humanity only when the ancient truths of the wisdom religion are once more perceived, when there is one purpose and one teaching. Its truths are self-evident, not to be accepted because written in this book, nor because they are the dicta of some particular church. They are the only truth worth considering because in the use of them, they prove themselves true. And truth, as we ought to know, always explains. When we have the explanation, we have the truth. Each one has to make his own verification of the truth. But the fact remains that there is truth, and it always has existed. It has come to us from beings higher than we, because once they turned their faces in the right direction and pursued the course pointed out to them.
excerpts from the Gita Notes by William Q. Judge. All of us are brought to this study by our own request to our higher self. Who is Krishna? It does not matter whether he now is consciously aware of having made the request, nor whether it was made as a specific act in this life or in any another precedent one. It was made, and it is to be answered at the right time. Some of us have asked this many times before in ancient births of ours, in other bodies, and other lands. Others are making the request now. But it is more than likely, in the case of those who are spurred on to intense effort and longing to know the truth and to strive for unity with God, that they have put up the petition ages since. We take up the gauge over and over, life after life, in experience after experience, never completely defeated, if we always look to Krishna, our higher self. All the passing shows of life, whether fraught with disaster or full of fame and glory, are teachers. He who neglects them neglects opportunities, which seldom the gods repeat. And the only way to learn from them is through the heart's resignation. For when we become in heart completely poor, we at once are the treasurers and dispersers of enormous riches. The attitude to be assumed then is that of doing every act, small or great, trifling or important, because it is before us to do. And as a mere carrying out by us as instruments of the will of that deity who is ourself. This practice is the highest, that which someday we must and will learn to perform. Effacement in the Supreme Spirit is gained by the right-seeing sage whose sins are exhausted, who hath cut asunder all doubts, whose senses and organs are under control, and who is devoted to the well-being of all creatures. If the last qualification is absent, then he is not a right-seeing sage and cannot reach union with the Supreme. It must follow that the humblest imitator, everyone who desires to come to that condition, must try to be the best of his ability to imitate the sage who has succeeded. And such is the word of the Master. For he says in many places that if we expect to have his help, we must apply ourselves to the work of helping humanity to the extent of our ability No more than this is demanded. Krishna says that those who with the eye of spiritual wisdom see that the self is all, begin to reincarnate with that belief ingrained in them. Hitherto, they may had come back to earth without that single idea, but possessed many desires and of ideas which separated them from the self. Now, they begin to return fully at rest in the self, working out their long accumulated karma. And at last, they become a Mahatma or a great soul.
This reading is from The Friendly Philosopher by Robert Crosby. In the work which we have undertaken together, it matters not whether we fail or succeed. Our purpose has been and will be that the work shall go on. We can throw, each one of us, our best into the effort. The rest is in other and stronger hands. It is then to the teaching that attention has to be called, not to ourselves, who are only handing them on as best we can. If one sees that in many ways he is not able to do all that he would like to accomplish, it is evidence that he is in the way of improvement. Our ideals are never reached. They continually precede us. As a man thinks, so he becomes. Time is an element in this, and it is shortened by patient doing of what we can. To be in the least cast down by our apparent imperfection is a form of impatience, a disregard of law. One of the greatest helps that theosophy gives us is the power to take a wider survey of the field of action than is otherwise possible. We do not look on this life only, but on many future lives, during which I and thou and all the princes of the earth will live and strive for the universal redemption of mankind. Ever looking ahead, ever seeking further heights toward which the awakening spirit may be directed. Could right philosophy be implanted, even the single idea of the divine nature in man, a greater impetus would be given to right living. Then a philosophy in accord with this nature would be sought by those so quickened. Theosophy, pure and simple, is the standard by which efforts may be applied and errors combated. So it must always be kept in evidence as the source of all right effort.
Robert Crosby would not have appreciated what was said about him. He never wanted attention called to him, which is the very reason for beginning the United Lodge of Theosophists, to take it away from persons and put it back on the teaching. However, we, in our gratitude for what he did, have to have this day
whether he would want it or not. And we think he would accept that and understand that. Consider the fact that at the time when this lodge here in Philadelphia was begun in 1925, along with its sister lodge in London, there were no copies of The Secret Doctrine. It went out of print in 1893. And unless you had one of the original copies, you couldn't get one. So we come to the crux of ULT. Mr. Crosby, as we heard, as a student working with Mr. Judge in contact with through mail with HPB, was a sincere and devoted student. And he was a student of the teachings, but pointing to the source, the masters, that brotherhood of adepts, the possessors and maintainers of the ancient wisdom religion. He knew that in order to keep theosophy alive for humanity, as well as for individual students, there had to be a way to have access to the original writings. So he and the group of seven students began studying together and began their plan for publication. Theosophy magazine was begun in 1912, and through it, the major articles of Judges and HPBs were reprinted. They were then turned into the pamphlets that we have out there for the amazing price of $2 each, and then were turned into a collection of articles. They are also online now, so these things are accessible. And that was the work of the Phoenix United Lodge of Theosophists. But just to go by the dates and by the method, Robert Crosby pointed away from himself. He never pointed, I did this, I did that. He pointed to the teachings and to the teachers, and the fact that each one had to do their own independent devotion. Just some thoughts we were noting. A lodge exists as a home for dialogue between students, a sanctuary where ideas can be examined. It probably in today's world, it doesn't seem so remarkable, but 50 years ago, if you talked about reincarnation, you were kind of a freak. And other people would not discuss such an idea with you. It was outside of the norm. But it's also, ULT is a place of self-education. We have study classes here. We are studying theosophy, but we're studying principles, universal laws and principles, and the object is to apply it to oneself. Yes, theosophy can be an intellectual exercise and a fascinating one at that. Just in increasing your vocabulary, it's wonderful. But that is just part of it. The real heart of it is the heart doctrine, applying the ideas you come to understand intellectually to oneself. So what was given as the structure of United Lodge of Theosophists is philosophy, not organization. Principles, not personalities. Souls, not positions. There's no officers, no dues, no fees, no constitution. We are all students, not teachers. That doesn't deny the fact that one, as a student, may know more than another student and represents a teacher to them, but that can change overnight, and we all know that. One individual can, by their own effort, far surpass us and then we become their student. We're workers, not followers. And we are free, not dependent. We are free to study, but the basis of that freedom is having the materials. ULT did what it did, that small group of students, without proselytizing, without creating rules and regulations and officers, and went to the original program of HPB and Judge to use the real method, to follow the lines that had been laid down. But it is pure and simple, a body of students. If you were to walk into any lodge anywhere in the world, you would be dealing with the same materials, the same ideas, and pretty much the same format. The fundamentals, the declaration, and then a study of a particular text or a lecture or a talk on a specific aspect of the philosophy. We were in the Paris Lodge once, and we actually understood maybe one third of what was being said, even though all of it was in French. You could feel it. So we would assume you could go anywhere and know that you were at home. The authentic texts that were reprinted, we don't think anything of it, do we? We can buy a secret doctrine, we can go online and see a secret doctrine, but at the time in 1925, when they republished or reprinted a photographic reprint of the original secret doctrine, at that time there were many secret doctrines for sale out in the world. One of them was a set of 13 volumes. One of them was pretty much the basic, original, but it had 100,000 corrections and alterations and changes. Well, if the masters, as they declared in a written statement that they were behind and with HPB in the authorship of the secret doctrine, if they made that claim and came forward and attested to their participation, why could someone else after that alter it and say this is what was meant and this is what gets changed? The object of ULT is you may read and study anything you like, any philosophy, any science, any author, but if you want to know theosophy, you should ground yourself in the original writings first, because that is how you compare anything else that has been written. ULT follows the method of Robert Crosby's non-authorship. It is always done anonymously, and students have followed along in that endeavor. The only time, twice he put his name to something. One was in writing about Mr. Judge after his death, and the other was the letter that was mentioned to all open-minded theosophists when he left the Theosophical Society. But he never wrote a book. He never wrote anything that had his name on it. And yet we have universal theosophy. Well, where did that come from? From lectures. Lectures that were transcribed and then produced as articles. The friendly philosopher, as was said, is letters that he wrote to various students. And if you've never read it, we strongly recommend at least read it. Go online, go on the Phoenix website and read it. We think once you do, you'll want to own it. It's like talking to your best friend who's 100 times smarter than you are. We, here at this lodge, are going to begin next Sunday with a study in self-development, which again is the principle of ULT. You do the unity, the study, and the work. It is up to you. So we ask you to pick up at the usher's table a copy of the material that we'll be studying for next Sunday. And then each Sunday in July and August, we'll be taking up a particular article. July and September. We'll be taking up a particular article that leads to a right understanding of self-development. So let's talk about some dates. In 1909, ULT was formed. It's funny, the things we don't think about, the simplest little things. Mr. Crosby, everyone who followed the group out to Point Loma in California gave everything they had, sold their homes, gave all the money, and therefore they had nothing. So when Mr. Crosby decided to leave after a few years, he literally was penniless. Well, in getting a job at the LA Times is what allowed him to advertise for free in order to attract students to come and study with him to see if they could do something along the lines of ULT. So we find things like that just delightful. He found that job, or that job found him. And then in 1909, after they had worked together for a couple of years, they began the United Lodge of Theosophists. They based it on the declaration that is on the back of our periodical. It's short, it's more than sweet, it's an unbelievable statement of freedom and of principles. And again, Mr. Crosby didn't write it. He gathered it together like a patchwork quilt out of statements by HPB and Judge. It's not his words at all. It's his effort, not his words. So the Declaration and the United Lodge was begun in 1909, and for a time, lodges were only in California, which makes sense. They were all very close to each other and in communication. But then in 1922, New York opened a United Lodge of Theosophists. And this was after the death of Robert Crosby and with the assistance of a student from the Theosophical Society in India, B.P. Wadia, who in coming to the United States and discovering the United Lodge of Theosophists realized he was meeting true theosophy for the first time. We have to remember at that point there were very few people in the world even calling themselves theosophists who had even read any of Blavatsky. They were reading the work of the people at that time who were publishing under the name of theosophy. So Mr. Wadia left the society and began working with ULT. And because of his efforts, the New York Lodge was started. A Philadelphia woman went to hear a lecture given by this Indian gentleman. And afterwards, when she spoke with him, he said, oh, he'd be happy to come to Philadelphia and help begin a lodge here, which is exactly what they did in 1925, at the same time that London opened. What's funny about that is Paris and Bombay didn't even have lodges then. The Philadelphia Lodge is very old in the scheme of things and very young and healthy at the same time. The unity between lodges is an odd one when you think about it, because each lodge is autonomous, absolutely independent, as long as it lives up to the Declaration. But lodges confer in the sense of sharing ideas, but no lodge is in charge of any other lodge. Each lodge is its own manifestation. So in 1925, ULT printed The Secret Doctrine, and in 1931, ISIS unveiled. And every time we pick up one of those, we should appreciate what it cost in time of money and service for these people to make this effort so that we would have the original writings. Without any proselytizing, without leaders in the sense of a personality directing something, ULT has grown into a worldwide movement. You can see, it's very small, but you can see there are 28 different lodges. Some of them in places you would not expect, like Brazil and Mexico and Haiti. And it's wonderful to know that there are students at work around the world with these same writings, these same teachings, with the same aim and purpose. I'm sure many of us have had friends ask, why do you keep going to those meetings? Why do you keep studying the same books? You must know it all by now. Not realizing that not only do we learn by that repeated effort, because when you are learning something, you change in the meantime, and you come to it, you are different. But there's also the opportunity to give back. It's gratitude, it's reciprocity, it's give as it was given to you, freely and independently. So the literature of the Theosophical movement, that's the leaders, that's the teachers, that's what is pointed to, not individuals. Individuals may stand out in one way or another, but they're not looked up to as a leader or as a teacher, but more as a goal, if you will. Sometimes we will see someone who understands something metaphysically or is able to express an idea so clearly, but instead of thinking that they're so far above us, it's more realizing there's a wonderful goal to achieve. How did they do it? What kind of study? How did they apply themselves? So there's no competition, because there's no valedictorian of the class. There is just students helping each other and students studying. And that's Robert Crosby's real distinction, because he always put the emphasis on principles, on ideas, not on persons. So you don't know who's going to, and be sure to pick up the July, August, September. You open for our Sunday meetings, and you don't know who's giving the talk. You just know the title. Because it doesn't matter who's giving the talk. The talk they're giving is based on the original writings of Theosophy. And if it isn't, if the student should slip in some way, there's always other students in the audience to let them know. No, that's not it exactly. And that's all right, because that's how we learn, by being corrected. Theosophy says the key to Theosophy has no two beliefs or hypotheses on the same subject. Theosophy has no two beliefs or hypotheses on the same subject. Yet, buy some of the material published as Theosophy, and you will find great conflicts between the expression. Go online, and the opposition of ideas is enormous. So what are we supposed to do? Well, one thing is to truly study the history of the Theosophical movement. If you don't want to go into the big text, which is from 1875 to 1900, we think, or 1925, then go on the shorter one. But understand, it's the same causes over and over. And the causes are personalities. You can go online, and some people say that they are arhats. Well, an arhat is the highest expression of that spiritual being, a master. The masters that were associated with this work never claimed arhatship, but we have people now who are claiming it. And there's no way for any of us to test whether that's true, except two facts. One, someone who is such a being would never say they are. And two, by their fruits ye shall know them. Does what is being given out by these individuals agree with what was originally given out? Within this storm, and it is a storm sometimes online, within this sort of battleground of theosophical ideas being altered and changed to suit the people or the group, there's this scream for unity. And what most of them mean by unity is it should be one big theosophical group. And within that one big theosophical group, everyone will agree to certain things. Well, ULT can't do that because ULT doesn't have officers and an organization. So ULT can't vote itself into this being of unity, and it can't make these individuals see why that's important, that it maintain and keep that. So we have, for the summer solstice, Theosophical Independence, you can pick it up at the usher's table, an article on the crisis of unity and its solution. The unity in ULT relates to principles, relates to the ancient wisdom religion and those tenets that have been passed on since the night of time. If we study the history along with the teachings, we then realize that these new exponents of theosophy are usually focused around a leader who claims some authority. And no student of ULT is going to accept that, because they are their own authority, and they have to be. Each one of us has to check for ourselves, is this true? Does this make sense? Does it fit with the fundamentals that we have been given? Does it leave any soul in any condition out? If the idea does, it's not true. It's not theosophical. Does whatever they're talking about happen under law? Not chance, not miracle, not special powers. Is there a law that is pointed to? And lastly, is it for learning, for growth, for sharing, and giving to all? There is no exclusivity. There is no price you can pay to become a leading theosophist. It cannot be sold to you. It already is yours within your own spiritual nature. And it's through study and application of principles that that is awakened within us. So these, we don't even know what to call them, these sad expressions of theosophical leadership are a kind of successorship. And as Mr. Judge wrote after HPV died, how can anyone succeed to another's knowledge and power? They can't. We don't need a teacher. We have the teachings. Judge didn't stand forward and say, I'm now the teacher. He said, I'm here to tell you, let's look at the teachings. Well, there's a quote from the Buddha. He's supposed to have said to Ananda as death was approaching, it may be, Ananda, that some of you will think the word of the teacher is a thing of the past. We have now no teacher. But that, Ananda, is not the correct view. The doctrine and discipline which I have taught and enjoined upon you is to be your teacher when I am gone. So when someone speaks to you of successorship in theosophy, quote the Buddha. It is the doctrine and the discipline which is to be your teacher. So ULT stays as a witness upon the scene, and each of us has the right and the responsibility to help point to the pollution on ideas, to point out what theosophy really teaches, and then let the chips fall where they may, and they may fall on us, because there's a lot of passion out there, just as we heard in the recent classes about spiritualism. There's a lot of intense feeling. Well, we think the masters would say that's good. Wherever there is intense feeling, things are happening, and someone may wake up in the midst of this kaleidoscope of strange ideas. We recall somewhere in letters, Mr. Judge writes about someone being criticized for standing in London handing out bulletins about theosophy, and that people thought that was in very bad taste. And he said, yes, but it attracted one of our better workers. So you never know what moment is going to trip something. We here, and any lodge, as a simple school of theosophy, that's all it is. It seeks no glory for itself. We work at giving out the original writings. And we'd like to remind you to check the usher's table. There's also the reading list for the Gita, the reading and online list for the Sunday mornings, and, of course, the new pamphlet. We thought we'd end with a quote from Mr. Judge. Mutually assisting and encouraging one another, we may learn how to put theosophy into practice so as to be able to teach and enforce it by example before others. We will then, each and all, be members of the universal lodge of free and independent theosophists, which embraces every friend of the human race. We invite you to stay and share in the fellowship.